Connection.com.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Now, the British Empire, some people will tell you, established itself in a fit of absent-mindedness. A bunch of businessmen and their royal backers decided to send the Red Ensign east in search of spice and other treasure. Soon enough, there were dozens of ships heading west, returning with stacks of beaver pelts and bales of tobacco. The British Empire grew, but it was more a matter of business than national ambition. In the years after the Second World War, U.S. President Harry Truman framed the concept of an American empire in both economic and moral terms. Here he is, speaking at Monticello, the home of Thomas Jefferson, on the 4th of July, 1947.
The United States has taken a leading role in furthering this ideal. We believe that it is essential to a peaceful and prosperous world. We believe that common knowledge and understanding among men can be greatly expanded in the years to come. We have the mechanical facilities, the radio, television, airplanes, for the creation of a worldwide culture. We have only to set them to work for international good.
Set them to work for international good. President Harry Truman laying out his vision of an American empire. Now, a new book by the soldier and scholar Andrew Bacevich argues the vision wasn't really about morals, or isn't rather now so much about morals. It was not about fighting for freedom and against evil. The American empire has always been about economics and sustaining the American lifestyle. Connection listeners, what do you consider to be the mission and the future of an American empire? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Andrew Bacevich is with me in the studio. He's director of the Center for International Relations at Boston University. His new book, American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy, is out next month. Now, Max Boot will be joining us in a couple of minutes. He's in a studio in Washington, senior fellow at the National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Max's book, out earlier this year, is called The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars, and the Rise of American Power. Andrew, first to you, your book. Now, this argument you're making is that whether we recognize it or not, there already is an American empire in place, right?
Yes. Yep.
And it is primarily an empire of, based on the economic interests of this country.
Well, it is based on the perception. It's based on a desire to maintain an American way of life, which we deeply cherish in this country. And if you ask, if I ask my students, what's the American way of life all about, I think the immediate and honest answer is that in the very first instance, the American way of life is about freedom. But peel that back a little bit further and ask yourself what it takes to maintain that freedom, what it takes to maintain this constitutional order, this set we have in this country of prerogatives and opportunities. And I think once you peel that back, you find that what we need to sustain the American life is material abundance, ever-growing abundance, this expectation that my son's life will be better than my life.
So if the captains of industry are up there in the wheelhouse with the politicians running the empire, that's in part the argument that's often made by the left.
It is, but it's not simply the captains of industry. The people, it seems to me, who are up there, who are the architects of American foreign policy, are genuinely wish to be responsive to the needs of the American people. They want to sustain that American way of life, and they have concluded, whether rightly or wrongly, and I'm not an economist, so I don't know if they're right or wrong, but they have concluded, whether rightly or wrongly, that we cannot sustain that ever-growing abundance absent access to the rest of the world for trade, for investment. And this leads to this grand vision, which is Truman's vision, not his originally, I think, but Truman's vision of creating a world that is open and integrated, first of all economically, subsequently politically and culturally, open and integrated, but also dominated by the United States of America, an international order in which we will remain the dominant power in the world. I think that that vision, which was expressed by Truman in 1947, is a vision that is very broadly shared among the foreign policy elite, whether they're Republicans or whether they're Democrats.
Max Booth, join us on this, on specifically whether or not Harry Truman framed the idea of empire that exists today.
Well, I think there are antecedents that go back long before Harry Truman, but I'd like to take issue with something that Andy just said. I mean, his book is perceptive in many ways, but I do think that he overemphasizes the economic aspect of American empire. When you look at so many American military interventions over the, going back hundreds of years, or just even 100 years, starting with our intervention in Cuba in 1898, right up through our more recent interventions in places like Bosnia, Somalia, Haiti, Kosovo, Afghanistan, it's very hard to find any kind of economic stake that America has in those kinds of places. In fact, the business community is often not beating the drums for war because they like, quote-unquote, stability. They're not in favor of these interventions necessarily, which are often undertaken for largely humanitarian reasons.
Well,
and
Mac,
that idealism, which is really a bedrock part of who we are as Americans, we are a country founded on ideals, I think has always been a major animating spirit in our diplomacy, in our foreign policy, in our national security policy.
Max and I certainly disagree on that. I mean, we do agree that, yes, let's take the case of Kosovo, that the U.S.-led intervention in Kosovo was not motivated by any immediate economic objectives in Kosovo. But it clearly was not motivated by the professed humanitarian considerations. And the evidence for that is that that war was conducted in such a way that it didn't really respond to the immediate needs of the Kosovo Albanians, who were being ethnically cleansed. If anything, we opened the way for Milosevic to accelerate the ethnic cleansing of Kosovo. But step back a little bit. What was Kosovo really all about? Well, Kosovo is about America's claim to being the leading power in Europe. You know, if you consider America's role in Europe since the end of World War II, it has been, on the one hand, the defense of Europe against Soviet expansionism, the containment policy, something that
all
I certainly...
All the American soldiers in Germany.
Right, and that I warmly endorsed. I'm glad we did, and I'm glad we won. But the American policy towards Europe is not simply about that. American policy towards Europe in the aftermath of the war was about nurturing the emergence of an open and integrated Europe over which the United States, or within which the United States, would play a dominant role. What was the chief expression of that U.S. leadership of Europe? The chief expression was NATO. The U.S.-led military alliance. The end of the Cold War called into question the viability, the purpose of NATO, and especially the misbehavior of Milosevic, first in Bosnia, subsequently in Kosovo, began to raise questions about, well, why do we have NATO? What's NATO supposed to do? And it was imperative for the United States to reinvent NATO, and to show that in the aftermath of the Cold War, NATO continued to have a purpose, and therefore the United States continued to be able to lay claim to this leading role.
Max.
Well, I don't disagree with any of that. I mean, I think those were valid concerns. But I think Andy nevertheless slights the role of idealism. I mean, the professed overwhelming reason for the American intervention in Bosnia and Kosovo was to end the ethnic cleansing. And I'm not cynical enough to say that was all just a ruse to fool people and deceive them from our real purpose. I think that was part of the real purpose. And it's much harder to find any kind of strategic rationale behind other expressions of American power, such as in Haiti or in Somalia. Nobody would say, for example, that we're trying to assert a dominant American role in Africa by intervening in Somalia. And I think it's a mixture of motives that leads to American intervention. I think the economic and strategic motives that Andrew Bacevich refers to are certainly real, but I don't think we can ignore the idealistic motive. And if somebody does ignore the idealistic motive, I think it's very hard to make sense of American actions, which sometimes make no sense at all, unless they're seen in that idealistic light.
Now, part of our look at American empire is also looking ahead rather than looking backwards. And Andy Bacevich in his book says that the cost of maintaining the empire is not something that, that people in this country are really focusing on. The economic costs, the basically just the price to the nation. Have I got that right?
Yes, you do have it right. And it's not just the economic cost. It's the human cost, a human cost that we suffer, a human cost that we inflict, and it's a moral cost. It's certainly not the point of the book to say that all those costs are so great that this enterprise that I characterize as an American empire is illegitimate.
Right.
But the costs, I think, are going to be far greater than advocates of this empire would suggest. And we American citizens who will bear those costs need to wake up to what the enterprise is all about.
In fact, you wrote an op-ed piece in a Boston paper not long ago specifically pointing to Iraq on that issue. But Max, just a bit from you perhaps about your sense of the cost of maintaining empire. Do you think that the picture is clear?
Well, there is a very real cost, and I think Andy is right to point it out. But I think we also have to focus on something else, which is the cost of not maintaining an empire, a cost of not taking an active and leading role in the world. And I think the cost of that is going to be higher than the cost of empire. We saw, in fact, the cost of not maintaining an empire on September 11th when we suffered devastating losses in the United States because essentially we had ignored this backward, distant corner of the world known as Afghanistan. We had let it fester and rot for a decade, and the result was that it became a breeding ground of terrorism, which came back to haunt us. I think that's a very clear example of how not taking a more imperial oversight role over some of these failed states results in huge costs to us, which are much greater than any possible cost that we can incur by going into Afghanistan and straightening things out.
But doesn't that play to Andy's argument that it's about money, that the cost of ignoring it is greater than the cost of doing something about it?
Exactly. But it's not the cost of ignoring it is largely not in money. It's
right.
It's measured in lives and in various other things. It's our very national security, which is at stake. I mean, there is some cost in money and it certainly costs money to go to places like Afghanistan or Iraq. And there's also the potential cost in human life of our soldiers getting killed, which we should not underestimate. That's a serious risk. Mm-hmm. But as opposed to that, the risk of letting these malevolent forces go unchecked, I believe, is much greater.
If I could just, I think my view is being a little bit mischaracterized. I don't think it's about just money. I tried to begin by saying that the purpose of the empire is to support the American way of life, and the American way of life is about much more than just money, but it requires abundance, and therefore there is a significant economic component. But no, we don't engage in these activities around the world simply because we're trying to fill the coffers of the fat cats on Wall Street. Our government undertakes these things because it views those things as necessary for the kind of country we want to live in.
Connection listeners, the kind of country we want to live in. Your thoughts on ideas about empire? What's behind it? Is it there? Is it, as my two guests are saying, something that's with us and simply in need of some better definition? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR 22.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Ideas of Empire. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program today, Andrew Bacevich. He's author of a new book called American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy. And he was 23 years in the U.S. Army, retiring as a colonel. He's now director of the Center for International Relations and a professor of international relations at Boston University. Max Boot is on the line with us from Washington, D.C. His recent book is called The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars and the Rise of American Power. This month, he became a senior fellow in National Security Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. You may recognize his name as an editorial features editor of the Wall Street Journal, something that he did for about 5 years. And it's probably worth just saying flat out here to both of you, or with both of you, that you folks are both on the right side of the ideas of empire, that there's a whole other school of thought on the left, liberal thought, which says, A, America should have nothing at all to do with empire. In fact, you can find that in the very words of the people who wrote the Constitution, in the words of President George Washington, you can take the information we have and use it to say you're wrong. The empire isn't there, and in fact, there's still an opportunity to guard against that. Andy,
I think that there is no chance to guard against it. I mean, I sense that somewhere back around 1940 or 1941, at the behest of Franklin Roosevelt, acting for reasons that I fully agree with, the need to defeat totalitarianism in World War II, that we all climbed aboard a train that was headed in a direction toward a destination we did not quite understand. And we've been riding that train for 60 years. And it is now time, especially after September 11th, it is time for us to begin to ask ourselves where we've been going so long. But because we've been going so long, I don't see any way to become unimperial. I don't see any way to shed our imperial obligations. I think that we need to have a serious national conversation about, again, what the costs are going to be. Does this empire have any limits? Have we done what is necessary to shape national institutions like the military to be as effective as possible in trying to manage this empire with the interest not just of ourselves, but perhaps the interest of others also in mind? And in my judgment, as long as the public conversation continues to say, what, us, an empire? Oh, heavens no. Then we can't really begin to grapple with the serious questions that we're facing.
But Max Boot, I hear people banging on the kitchen table and talking about entangling alliances and, you know, no.
Well, I think we need to have a clear-eyed view of American history, and I agree with Andy to that in that respect. And it goes way back before 1940. The United States was a great empire even in the 19th century. Thomas Jefferson talked of the Empire of Liberty. Many of the founding fathers talked about our imperial role in spreading American civilization west, ever westward. And once we had filled up the entire North American continent from sea to shining sea, American power moved inexorably overseas with another major move outward in 1898 when we defeated the Spanish Empire and took Cuba and the Philippines and other possessions from them. So our imperial history is very long, but I think we need to stress one thing. America is not an empire of the traditional type. We have experimented with traditional colonialism in 1898, and we were not very happy with the results when we tried to annex the Philippines and had to wage a bloody war to put down Filipino resistance. Since then, we have not annexed any territory overseas, nor do we seek to do so. Ours is a very different kind of empire, an informal empire, if you will, run for a variety of motives. Andy stresses the strategic and economic motives. I would also add the idealistic motive, but it's basically an empire to the sense that we are spreading our ideals and we are trying to protect free peoples around the world. We are taking a leadership role with liberal, free market, democratic countries all over the world, and we're trying to spread those ideals to countries where they have not yet penetrated. That's what our imperial role consists of. It doesn't consist of planting the stars and stripes everywhere as the Union Jack was once planted everywhere. That's not the sort of empire America is. So I think if you realize that we're an empire of a different type, then the imperial label fits. But if you try to fit America into the old imperial categories of 19th century European colonialists, then I don't think it really fits.
All right. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Let's start in Buffalo, New York. Leo's on the line. Hello, Leo.
Hello. How are you today?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
This is a very interesting topic. I think you're completely abusing the word empire. I mean, typically throughout history, what empire has entailed is military conquest and occupation, the assignment of viceroys to run the occupied territories, the enslavement of the population, either through impressing into the military or through forced labor, and the extermination of anybody who wouldn't be subjugated.
But isn't that a little bit risky, Leo, just rooting the argument completely in history? If you talk about one empire's control of the sea by using a fleet of ships, doesn't mean we have to have a fleet of ships to rule the seas now. You can do that with national missile defense. And I guess what I'm wondering is whether or not the definition changes with the way that the world changes. See what I'm saying?
No, I don't. I think that basically the use of the word empire is a play to the emotions of people who have been through it. And, you know, the cultures that have been through empires. And, you know, it isn't just the 19th century that it ended in. I mean, in the 20th century, the Nazis and the Soviets and the Chinese all did exactly the same thing, impressed people, levied taxes, had slavery, still have slavery in some places, and forced people into, you know, destroy people's religions and occupy those. I mean, that's typical of Islamic imperialism, is to encroach upon people's religions and force that kind of thing. And, you know,
hang on a sec, Leo. I think you've made your point, but stay with us here. Max, do you want to go first?
I'd like to make a plea for a somewhat richer and deeper understanding of the different permutations of empires. I mean, what Leo is referring to, yes, that is something that some empires have done. The Soviet Empire was, as Ronald Reagan said, an evil empire. There were certainly other evil empires. For example, what the Belgians did in the Congo in the 19th century was just evil. There's no other word for it there. Horrible exploitation of that country. But other things that empires have done have not been evil, and some of them have been extremely good. For example, in the 19th century, the British Empire stamped out the slave trade. The Royal Navy went out and intercepted slaving ships on the high seas, destroyed the slaving stations in Africa. This was a moral crusade that the British undertook because they were led to do so essentially by their conscience. There was no real practical gain to the British, and in fact some loss, because a number of British fortunes were built on slavery. But nevertheless, they went out and did these idealistic things. So that's also part of what the empire is about. And I think our tradition of empire, as I was trying to stress, is very different from that of the Soviets or the Belgians or so forth. It's much closer to that, more to the more idealistic side of the British imperialism, such as stamping out the slave trade or the thuggy cult in India.
Andy, I think Leo's reaction is it's in a very American reaction. We bridle against the notion of America being an empire, and we wish to deny some very important facts. I don't agree entirely with Max about the high ideals that inspire our foreign policy, but Max is clearly right that our empire is radically different from the British Empire, from the Roman Empire. But it is an empire. The object of the exercise is dominance. It may well be, in our eyes, a benign form of dominance, but it's dominance. And more to the point, it's an empire, it's an imperial effort that elicits resistance. You can say we're not an empire, but we sure as heck have an imperial problem, that in regions of the world where we attempt to assert that dominance, we find major resistance. And, of course, the most vivid expression of that was the attack of 9/11.
So, Leo, let me ask you a question, Leo. If what we're describing is, in your view, not an empire, what is it?
I have no idea. Perhaps it is time to coin a new word, but the word empire has a specific meaning and a historical context. And in truth, where we meet resistance is the places that, you know, basically formed empires themselves, including all of Europe. Anytime any of them came into ascendancy, they marched to war and they formed a traditional empire, including the British, whose idealism didn't come until they were in decline, basically. When they were building their empire, they did exactly as every other empire ever did.
What about the argument that's being presented to you, that just the very notion, just the word itself, sticks sideways in the craw of Americans, because this country was formed in a revolution which was determined to break free from empire, and the idea is something that nobody wants to countenance?
Well, that is exactly why I'm saying that the use of the word empire, very much like the use of the word Nazi that gets thrown away, right, is strictly an emotional appeal and has no basis in fact. I mean, when we had an opportunity, when we came into our real ascendancy, we didn't form empires. Instead, we asked the world to join the League of Nations and then the United Nations, which are both American concepts. And we aren't an imperial place at all. I mean, you know, the places that are objecting to us as an empire are the places who not only would, but actually did try to form a traditional empire when they came into ascendancy.
Leo, I'm going to move along, but I want to thank you for calling up. Nice to have you on the program. Andy Quickman?
Well, I understand the reaction, and if he wants to call it global hegemony and that makes him feel better, I mean, one could do that. But I would urge listeners, for example, to take a look at the Bush administration's national security strategy that was just released last month. It's about a 20-25-page document that sort of says, here's where we've come to. And it is redolent with the language of empire, at least in my judgment. You know, you made reference to sort of founding ideals and where we began as an anti-imperial nation. We also began as a nation that had an aversion to military power, that we thought here in this new world we were going to create something that where war was irrelevant,
was
over there in the old world. And it is striking to me at least, the extent to which having ascended to the status of sole superpower, meaning possessing more military power than the rest of the world together, that there is, again, this very broad consensus that accepts that. This is part of what America means today, to be the world's sole military superpower. That's a big deal that deserves more sort of thought than it gets, it seems to me, and it is one expression of this imperialistic thrust of our policy.
Well, and it's also a term and a reference that much of the rest of the world doesn't have anywhere near as much difficulty defining as people here in this country
right. Do.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255 to Durham, North Carolina. Nick's on the line. Hello, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine.
I'm thinking that if we don't change our ways, so to speak, as a military superpower, and using that power solely in war, the cost to us as a nation is going to be far greater than any military dollars that we might ever expend.
Have you got some experience here that you use to?
Yes, I spent 20 years in the Caribbean in the 70s through the 90s, and I was struck in my travels as a real estate developer at Castro's use of physicians who would live among the people and help them because they were totally impoverished, as are most of these Caribbean islands, and was made, as many people know, during the 70s, great headway in fermenting communism and anti-Americanism throughout the Caribbean.
Well, where does America fit in here, Nick?
And I think that America, and Harry Truman made it very clear, and Dwight Eisenhower made it clearer, saying, watch out for the military-industrial complex. And I think John Kennedy saw it even more clear that we really needed to take steps to use our economic might to better the world. And for very few dollars, we can do a great deal to help people who see help in the form of medical care as opposed to seeing one of our destroyers offshore. I can give you an example. In Dominica in the 70s, which was under tremendous pressure from communist ideology, a hurricane hit and the American Sixth Fleet was rotating out. And as they followed that hurricane in, they were ordered to stop, and the Dominican people, for the first times in their lives, saw the real power and and goodness of American people. And you can imagine what a fleet like that can do.
Nick, I want to stop you because I know the thing that you're talking about. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio.
I think if...
It's where you end the book, figuring out how you want to define it, right?
But if Max is right about the idealism as the sort of the dominant theme of our empire, then one would think that Nick's wishes would be fulfilled, that we would be out doing good in the world and that we would emphasize sort of foreign policy as social work.
But what about the argument?
But we don't. We emphasize... We're willing to pay much more to sustain our military power than we are willing to spend on doing good works in the world.
Max?
Well, we do a fair amount of good works in the world. I mean, that example in Dominica is not an isolated example. The U.S. Armed Forces often participate in hurricane relief or in feeding areas ravaged by famine and so forth. I think that's actually a very longstanding tradition in America, which goes back over 100 years. It's not a new thing. But let's be clear about one thing. I mean, the caller talked about how Fidel Castro was spreading his influence by sending doctors around Central America and so forth. And it's true that Castro does do that. But I would question how much influence it actually spreads. I mean, we have to be clear about the fact that, as far as I know, there's not a single example in history of a communist party coming to power through a popular vote. Communists and people like Fidel Castro don't take power through the liberal democratic process by winning over people. They take power through the gun, and that's something to keep in mind. I mean, I'm all in favor of the kind of altruistic measures that the caller calls for, but we have to realize there are certain limits to foreign aid and there are certain limits to hearts and minds measures. They have to be married up with a hard-headed assessment of how do you defend American interests and also ideals, which defending those ideals often requires the use of force as well.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We move this conversation about empire into the issues that face this country right now, Iraq, North Korea, Afghanistan, and how the expression of empire is bearing out the different perspectives of exactly what it is and what it should be. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. This hour, American Empire. If it's here, what is it? What do we do about it? With me on the program, Max Boot, author of The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars, and the Rise of American Power, and Andrew Basevich, author of American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy. So why don't we just go right to the pointy edge of U.S. diplomacy right now with Colin Powell and company in New York talking about Iraq with the rest of the world. And does an empire sit there with its hands folded in its lap and wait for the French to say that this is an acceptable set of circumstances? Does an empire behave differently from that? How do we understand what's happening with Iraq in context that you guys are describing? Andy, do you want to start?
Well, I mean, again, ours is an empire that is different than other empires. And it seems to me that what's going on with the United Nations is that the Bush administration is committed to achieving regime change in Iraq.
Does that mean committed to war in Iraq?
I think so. And let me get to that in a second. I think so. The regime change. Again, the president's been saying some things recently that suggest that if we get rid of the weapons of mass destruction program, that could, in a sense, constitute regime change. I think that that's simply trying to placate European opinion, because we want to be able to achieve our objectives in Iraq without having to alienate Europe again, which is a valued precinct, perhaps the most valued precinct in this empire. But yes, we want regime change in Iraq, and we want regime change in Iraq not because Saddam Hussein is, as the president says, a murderous thug. I mean, he is a murderous thug. He's been a murderous thug for a long time. But we want to do this now because, as people like Paul Wolfowitz and Zalmay Khalilzad of the National Security Council staff has suggested, we're embarking upon a major project to bring about the transformation of the Arab world and perhaps more broadly the Islamic world, and we intend to make Iraq the first Arab democracy, and then we intend to make more Arab democracies. And we're doing that, Max would probably say, we're doing that because we believe in democracy, and we do. But we're doing that because we determined as of September 11th that the principal threat to this empire, the principal threat to our well-being, is violent anti-American radicalism coming out of the Islamic world. And we intend to defeat that threat. And the threat is not simply Al-Qaeda. It's much broader, and we and Iraq is step number one.
The definition of what the American empire will be is found in Iraq, Max.
There's some truth to that. One point I'd like to make, which doesn't get enough attention, I think, is how extraordinarily restrained America has been in the exercise of its unique global hegemony. I use that word advisedly, restrained, because everybody talks about the arrogance of American power and how we're a big bully and so forth. But if you actually compare our actions to those of previous great powers, including many of the countries who are now criticizing us, such as France and Germany and various others, if you look at how they acted when they were great powers, when they had a fraction of the kind of power we now deploy, they were much less solicitous of the what we now call world opinion. In 1940, when a pro-Nazi regime came to power in Iraq, Britain simply overthrew that regime. It didn't bother asking permission from any other country. It just went and did it. And that's the way things worked up until fairly recently. We have been fairly restrained about our exercise of power, and I think in some instances, to my mind, too restrained, because we have allowed real dangers to fester while waiting for the United Nations to act. Now, on the question of what happens in Iraq going forward, I mean, I think it's very hard to disentangle our idealism from our interests, because those two things generally go hand in hand, and it is very much in our interest, I believe, to build a more liberal and democratic regime in Iraq. But if we were simply approaching things from a hard-headed realpolitik standpoint, that is not necessarily the policy we would pursue. In fact, a lot of people on the right, especially, who consider themselves sort of hard-headed, Kissingerian-type realpolitikers, say, you know, this is a foolish dream. Why don't we just go kill Saddam Hussein, blow up Baghdad, and be done with it? Why do we have to worry about building up something more positive in its place? But the reason that we're doing that is because this is what America is all about.
But the whole idea of the benign sheriff that you're describing is only, you know, in step one, because Andy's sitting here talking about making Arab democracies. What if the Arabs don't want to be made into democracies?
Well, then the
sort of soft edge of the empire.
That's what's, I mean, again, distinguishing our empire from other empires. Max is right. I mean, in comparison to other empires, we do demonstrate a certain restraint in the way we use our power, on the one hand. On the other hand, our aims have such grandeur. They're so stupendous that they're far more ambitious than anything that the emperors of Rome or the kings of England would have conceived. I mean, we declare that, as in the president's recent national security strategy, that there is a single model of sustainable national success. And we know what that is. That's democratic capitalism. Now, I believe in democratic capitalism, and it works here, and it works other places. But it is extraordinary that we would state that basically to the entire world, you must do it this way. And again, I think in the context of the Persian Gulf right now, we think that we have a compelling security requirement to begin to bring about a transformation in that region so that it reflects those values.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255. To Burlington, Vermont, Jerry's on the line. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I have a couple of points I hope I can make. One is that imperialism is always deadly. It's always deadly to the people that come in. And it's nice to hear this discussion happening, because I think just a couple of years ago, people were just totally in denial about imperialism. the fact that that guy Leo said before that it doesn't hold up to those old models. Well, that's true, but the whole world has changed. I consider NAFTA an imperialist model, and I'd like to hear somebody show us where all the jobs were that NAFTA was going to provide for the United States and Canada. All of these things ultimately are brought about through a gun. And these terrible people that you're talking about, and I grant that they are, virtually all of them are brought into power by the United States. You know, then they say, oh, well, we're virgins. We didn't mean anything by that. We didn't mean Saddam Hussein should do what he did. But it's the United States who put him in there, and they put him in there for not good reasons. They never did. And I think even now we're starting to see that Afghanistan, you know, the wonderful democratic change that was going to happen in Afghanistan is not going to happen. It's going to go back. Only women won't be wearing burqas as much.
So, Jerry, are you on board with the idea of empire? Is that why you're calling?
No, I'm very much against it. I don't think the United States or any other country has the right to invade, to vampirize. And as far as this being against U.S. ideals, you may be forgetting about the Indians in this country, you know, the native population in this country. But Manifest Destiny and all of those rationalizations, all of those slogans were used to expand the empire, and the United States doesn't want to have troops in the way, and it says it all the time, doesn't want to have troops. And of course they're going to go in there and put their puppet in power and say, okay, now do what we want. Don't say the United States, as somebody just said there, the United States has been so restrained, when we have the history of Vietnam and Southeast Asia, which has been stopped only because it was defeated. I mean, that particular history is on hold. I don't think it's going to be on hold for long, and it would be preferable to have surgical strikes, et cetera, you know, so the United States bodies don't come back the way they
Jerry,
did.
Jerry, let me just step in there if I can. I mean, one of the sort of overriding features of what Jerry's saying, Max, let me put this one to you, is that the people who are a part of an empire always say that whatever the empire is doing is good for the people that it's doing it to. Is the U.S. Guilty in this case?
Well, I just think you have to distinguish between the kind of empire that we're attempting to create in previous empires. I mean, it's one thing with the Soviet Union or with France or with other countries who would come into a place and impose their administrators on the population and then try to keep those people under essentially a foreign dictatorship. That's not the kind of empire that we're trying to run. The kind we're trying to run is where we come in, we depose a despotic regime. We help to establish a democratic regime, and then we want to leave as soon as possible.
Yeah, but it's
because there's guns
behind the diplomats, right?
Well, there's guns behind the U.S. government, too, but that doesn't mean the U.S. government isn't democratic and liberal and free. It is. But those liberal and free ideals have to be protected from bad people who want to take power and usurp power, and that's the problem that we confront in the world. And what the United States is trying to do is to protect freedom and democracy. And much of the success and appeal of America depends on the fact that our ideals are also the ideals of most people around the world.
Are we too timid there here, Andy, in talking about triggers and tanks and things?
Well, I mean, we're interested in defending freedom and democracy, but we're interested in defending American freedom and American democracy and our commitment, our willingness to pay for freedom and democracy in other countries has its limits. I mean, earlier Max talked about the roots of the American empire in the 19th century. In many respects, the first sort of province of the American empire was Latin America. It's very difficult to sustain an argument that American interventionism in Latin America was motivated by a sincere desire to create freedom and democracy. It's easy to sustain an argument that American intervention in Latin America, well before World War II, was motivated by a concern for American interests, real American interests, economic interests, and other interests.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And I have to tell you, Max and Andy both on this, that we do get a number of people who will call this program and say that the best expression of American empire was kids in the Peace Corps who weren't carrying guns but were carrying those American ideals abroad to different countries in quite a different way. What about that part of the argument?
I don't have a problem with the Peace Corps. I think they do a lot of good work. And in fact, I think in places like Kosovo or Bosnia or Afghanistan, where American arms have won battlefield victories, we need precisely those kind of people to come in and to create stable and lasting institutions. That's how you transform immediate military success into long-term right. political success. You need to build up institutions of a democratic society, of government, of schools, of a free press, and those kinds of things are not done by the military alone. They have to have other components of society to foster those areas, and we were tremendously successful in doing that in post-World War II Germany, Italy, and Japan, and I hope that we will be able to replicate some of that success elsewhere around the world.
But if we take the example of Afghanistan, the Peace Corps couldn't operate in Afghanistan now. You need the American soldiers there with guns. That's
I agree,
part
absolutely.
Of what it,
and
Empire
Peace Corps, the Peace Corps, I mean, I'm not going to speak against the Peace Corps, but
no,
it's a
I'm
very small institution.
Yeah.
But if indeed we're serious about Max's terms, bringing democracy to Afghanistan, yes, it's going to require a much larger investment. And again, to acknowledge that we are an empire then allows us to begin to ask the questions of whether we have the necessary instruments and the gumption and the will to foot the bills to manage this empire. And it seems to me Afghanistan is an example where the evidence so far would say that, no, we don't have the willingness to foot the bills.
America, you write, is Rome, but hardly cause for celebration.
Well, I don't think it is. I in many respects, I think that if the founding fathers rose up from their graves and took a look at what was the results of their handiwork, they would be disturbed that this is not their vision of what this republic was supposed to be. But this is the republic we have become. We have become not simply the New Jerusalem that we thought we were going to be back in colonial days, but the New Jerusalem that is also the new Rome. And I think it's time to begin to face the facts.
Max, are you nodding your head yes or no on that one?
I don't think the Founding Fathers would be at all disturbed by American greatness and the way America is leading the world. And I think it is in many respects a cause for celebration, because can you just imagine what the alternatives are? If one looks at the previous countries and that have sought global hegemony, such as the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany or Napoleonic France, the idea of one of those countries dominating the world would be a horrible thing. The fact that we are the dominant power means that a country dedicated to liberal principles is the most powerful country in the world. And if you believe in those principles as I do, and as I suspect most listeners do, that is a cause for celebration.
But let us embrace those principles, but let us also understand that there will continue to be many in the world who will resist them, and therefore that ensuring that those principles prevail in order to maintain our way of life is going to be a bloody enterprise.
Andrew, thanks for coming in.
Oh, thank you.
Andrew Bacevich, professor of international relations at Boston University, author of American Empire, The Realities and Consequences of U.S. Diplomacy. Max Booth, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Max is a senior fellow in national security studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, author of The Savage Wars of Peace, Small Wars, and the Rise of American Power. Graham Smith is our senior producer. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is WBUR.